democracy and politics. The Attitude provides the facts and stories that define our lives.
KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media. We discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
Just an FYI, be registered to vote, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. Okay, from communityimpact.com, House bill inspired by Pearland financial troubles aims to allow tax worksheet recalculation for cities. Because this is a story we've kind of been following. A Texas House bill filed in February aims to allow municipalities to rework already certified property values after the Pearland staff encountered an incorrect tax worksheet that brought the city a $10.3 million deficit. State House Rep. Ed Thompson, Representative Pearland, filed the bill February 23rd. What a coincidence that is, actually. Thompson's chief of staff, Benjamin Williams, said the bill HB 2714 would allow municipalities to recalculate their property tax worksheets after the rolls have been certified. Tax rolls give information on the value of properties. The city eventually received a corrected worksheet from the Brazoria County Tax Assessor Collector, allowing the city to move forward with next year's budget process with the correct values. Thompson said Pearland officials contacted him after discovering the worksheet error to discuss what could be done at a state level to address the issue. He said he hopes the bill can allow cities facing any similar circumstances in the future to cure the problem themselves. And so the continuing saga of Pearland's tax roll faux pas is now a state problem to fix. This seems to be a case of stuff rolling uphill. We'll keep you posted of any further developments in this story. Andrew?
While I'm not so concerned with what body takes steps to stop a screw-up like this from happening again, as much as I am how that body tries to resolve the issue. The article doesn't analyze the text of Representative Thompson's bill, so I hope to see someone with experience take a look at it soon and give their thoughts on whether it's a good proposal or could be gamed.
Maybe not the people that screwed up the tally the first time.
Ideally, yeah.
Ideally. Okay, from communityimpact.com, Jersey Village Police Department releases 2022 racial profiling report. Traffic stops by the Jersey Village PD in 2022 were disproportionate to the city's population, which is 62.5% white and 12.7% black residents. Out of the nearly 7,500 traffic stops conducted last year, about 36% of them were white drivers and 36% were black drivers. In compliance with state law, the city of Jersey Village released its 2022 racial profiling report as part of the February 27th City Council meeting packet. Traffic stops for Hispanic, Latino, Asian Pacific Islander, and Alaska Native American Indian were more consistent with city population statistics, according to the report. The report clarified that more than 13% of traffic stops were conducted along Highway 290, a major corridor connecting commuters and residents throughout a larger region of Harris County. I also want to point out that there is a really lovely graphic that you can see by clicking on the story at thinkwingradio.com. I could read you all the stats, but I'm afraid your eyes would glaze over. Instead, if you're interested, I do strongly suggest going to the blog post and clicking on the full story, and you can then decide for yourself whether you want to take the stats in this report at face value or whether you think they may have been massaged. As Mark Twain is credited as saying, and I have a link to that story, there are three kinds of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics. Andrew?
Well, I think this data would have been much more useful had the stops along 290 been filtered out, which I hope they do next time. Despite that, I think the report definitely shows racial bias in the JVPD. In terms of data accuracy, I think the discrepancy between black residents and stopped black drivers is too large for data manipulation to affect much. If I were auditing this report, I'd take a closer look at the data for stopped Latina, Asian, and Native drivers, as those differences are much smaller.
I was wondering how you're going to pronounce that word. So now
I've said it a few times.
Latina?
Yeah, I've said it a few times.
Not to me.
On the show, yeah, but you don't remember
it. Oh, I don't pay attention. No. That would be rude. I do pay attention to what you say, or else I couldn't argue with you.
Or else you couldn't argue, yeah.
I just want to say that, you know, the 290 portion of the traffic stops, a year, two, three ago, Jersey Village annexed a commercial development across Highway 290. So now they have a contiguous piece of property or part of Jersey Village that goes across 290. Now, depending on what percentage of the stops on 290 were non-white, that could completely skew the numbers.
Sure. And that's why I suggested them to be filtered out.
Oh, I thought that was an excellent point, by the way, because I was listening. Okay. From communityimpact.com, the Texas General Land Office, or GLO, posts Harris County Amendment to Hurricane Harvey Plan. This has been an ongoing story for 5 years. At the request of Harris County, the Texas General Land Office posted an amendment to the Hurricane Harvey State Action Plan for $57.8 million in the Community Development Block Grant Disaster Recovery Funds, according to a February 27th news release. All the names are so long, it kills me. The GLO is federally required to post this amendment for a 14-day public comment period. The amendment pertains to funding allocated to Harris County by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, according to the release. The amendment includes the following changes requested by Harris County. A voluntary buyout program decreased to $11.8 million. Mandatory buyout increased to $15.1 million. And the affordable rental program supplement increased to $16.6 million. Community Impact previously reported $750 million in community development block grant mitigation funds were part of an amendment to the GLO's state action plan to invest in infrastructure improvement in areas damaged by Hurricane Harvey. I got to tell you, the people waiting all these years for that money, so screwed. However, after GLO announced both Harris County and the city of Houston were excluded from the list of recipients in a competition for CDBG funds, despite having a combined 51% of the population eligible for the grant, changes were requested. I know this is a little hard to digest by ear, but basically, when Governor Abbott gave his State of the State speech, did he ever mention that he and other Republicans in state government were basically at war with Harris County, the most populous county in Texas, one of the most populous counties in the United States, because it leans Democratic in elections? Did he? No, I don't think so, because a government at war with a segment of its citizenry over political differences is a very Trumpian attitude to take. Andrew?
I wouldn't call it Trumpian. I'd call it Republican or American. I've seen politicians from both major parties and independents wage war against parts of the populace that didn't vote for them, whether through underfunding or gerrymandering or a number of other tactics. Unfortunately, sidelining political opponents in a system that is supposed to be neutral is a widespread problem in the U.S. Hopefully, ranked choice voting and other electoral reforms can help combat it. In the meantime, I hope to see lots of supportive public comments on the aforementioned amendment.
I think this is a place where our age difference is showing. Not that, you know, politics has never been played, and not that it's never been nasty, but what we're seeing in the most right-wing states is the difference between rewarding Republican supporters and actually punishing communities that don't win elections for them. And there is a distinction, especially since even those communities have Republican supporters living within them. at least generationally speaking, this is relatively new in U.S. politics, and it became particularly common as a symptom of Trump's vindictiveness.
I don't think so. I think that there has been a long sort of political current practice of this, and that this case is more of an evolution of that longstanding practice than an escalation.
Perhaps so, perhaps not. Maybe a little of both. Okay, from the Houston Chronicle, as a person who's done a lot of driving in my life, this is something that resonates with me. Harris County drivers to save at the toll booth with new easy tag reductions. Drivers who use Harris County toll roads will see a rollback in their costs starting this fall. Harris County Commissioner's Court on Tuesday approved a 10% reduction in toll fees for most drivers, establishing a new rate system as the Harris County Toll Road Authority, or HCTRA, continues its transition to all electronic tolling and aims to convince more drivers to get easy tags. To give the taxpayers a little discount is a good thing, Precinct 3 Commissioner Tom Ramsey said. Tom Ramsey, the Republican commissioner who is now outnumbered and might as well make lemonade out of lemons. That's me. That is not what the Houston Chronicle said. The policy changes announced last week would drop the price of tolls along the Sam Houston and West Park tollways and Harris County portions of the Tomball Tollway along Texas 249 and the Fort Bend Tollway south of US 90A and the Hardy Toll Road and Katy Managed lanes along Interstate 10. The new rates would go into effect in September once HCTRA finalizes the details and then changes all of its internal billing systems to levy the lower prices. Tuesday's vote marks the first ever decrease in HCTR rates and the first change in tolls since September 2015. The policy changes also, and this is significant, also will allow people to get easy tags for free, ending the practice of charging $15 simply to register a vehicle to use the toll roads. I think it's vitally important we try to help the underbanked, Precinct 1 Commissioner Rodney Ellis said. The savings, however, only will happen on HCTRA-controlled tollways. In recent weeks, tolls increased along the Grand Parkway, portions of the Tomball Tollway outside Harris County maintained by the Texas Department of Transportation, and toll lanes along Texas 288, which is maintained by the private Blue Ridge Transportation Group under an agreement with TxDOT. With the discount, a toll road user's five-day weekly commute could drop in price by $10 or more each month. That, of course, would be per car. Someone who passes through two main lane tolling points along the Sam Houston Tollway, for example, would save 60 cents round trip each day or $3 a week. The discount will apply only to those with easy tags issued by HCTRA. Those paying with another transponder, such as TexTag, or the transponders used by the North Texas Tollway Authority will not pay the lower tolls. Roughly 95% of all toll road drivers have a transponder, Toll Road Executive Director Roberto Trevino said. Officials last week defended the plan, saying many struggling families rely on the toll roads and deserve the relief. By lowering rates and making easy tags free, Precinct 2 Commissioner Adrian Garcia said, officials are appealing to those who have historically avoided the system, many of whom live inside the Sam Houston Tollway. Longtime listeners to this show will know that I personally have philosophical and social issues with toll roads in general. Nonetheless, there is a lot to like here. A 10% reduction in tolls may seem small. A potential saving of $3 a week in commuting may seem modest, but it does add up in a family budget per trip and per car. I really like making the easy tags free instead of charging a registration fee. Tags save the HCTRA money. Now they won't charge you for the privilege of saving them money. There's even help for the underbanked in this new program. Folks can get an easy tag with no credit card or bank account. They can run through a toll booth and arrange to pay the tolls incurred online without extra fees. This is a rare consideration given to struggling citizens and should be applauded. There are still some details about pre-funding on Easy Tag with a credit card or not that are unclear to me. And how does someone without a credit card or bank account pay their tolls? Do they go to an HCTRA store, because there are some? Do they pay at a supermarket service desk? Have they worked on this? But overall, this is one of the best examples in recent local memory of elections having consequences. Do you think that a Republican-dominated Harris County Commissioner's Court would have passed this policy? I suggest you draw your own conclusions. By the way, I have included some EasyTag pricing information, or at least there is some in the reference that I've included with the story at thinkwingradio.com. It's not recent, and it's going to be changing in the coming months, but it does give you some idea of where the plans are currently. Andrew, any additional comments on that?
Just that it's not an episode of Think Wing until we talk about toll roads.
Yes. Yes, that's true. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2. You can listen live online at kpft.org. I suppose that if you're listening, you figured out how to listen. So I'm going to skip that part for today. Every story on the show is heavily excerpted. By the way, I do want to mention you can listen on Google Podcasts. I do recommend that. I do link to full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. You can click on show posts and more at the top of the webpage and find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. You can also type keywords into the search bar, which is how I find stuff that I wrote years ago. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig and look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. And tongue ties, apparently.
That's tongue ties are the best.
That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
All right. You remember I have recently been complaining a lot about abbreviations, long names, and acronyms. Well, here we go. The NHCRWA board drops water rates by 50 cents. And I did not make a note of which news media I got this from.
That is from Community Impact.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. You see, I have to pay attention to him because he catches me when I fall.
Yep.
The North Harris County Regional Water Authority, NHCRWA, has seen a change in leadership and the lowering of water rates since last fall, two historic moves for the authority. In the November 8th election, candidates Mark Ramsey, David Barker, and Melissa Rowell unseated three long-term incumbents. In early 2023, the new board then voted to lower water rates for the first time in the authority's 22-year history, effective February 1st. The Water Authority is tasked with securing, this is important, pay attention, it's tasked with securing a long-term supply of drinking water for the North Houston region, including the Tomball area, according to its website. Basically, they're trying to convert, as mandated, from groundwater to surface water. Ramsey, the president of the board, said the new board members campaigned to hold water rates constant, but after finding a $30 million surplus in the operating budget in January, the board decided to reduce the rates by an amount it believes is sustainable. Surface and groundwater rates were reduced by 50 cents per 1,000 gallons. Ramsey said the reserves that were in several accounts were far, far higher than what was a reasonable level. We certainly don't want to run out of money, and we don't want to go bankrupt, but neither do we need hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank. So these rate cuts, in part, are funded by the rates being too high in the past, Ramsey said. Ramsey said lowering the rates cost a $25 million loss in projected revenue. However, the reserve budget is still in excess of $300 million, he said. Before 2023, the NHCRWA website shows water rates steadily increased every 2 years, with the last raise in April 2021. Kelly Fessler, one of two remaining incumbents following November's election, said the former board was not planning to raise rates this year. I believe the former board was on the right track to achieve our mandated surface water conversion, and if they had received the same guidance, it may or may not have reduced the rate. Basically spoken like a politician who is now outnumbered on the board. Andrew?
Where would Mike and I be without complicated local politics and acronyms like this? Just to quickly make something as clear as possible, Ramsey said lowering the rates caused a $25 million loss in projected revenue. That means from the $30 million projected surplus they would have this year, they have now projected it will be a $5 million surplus. So that's what that means. I think the residents clearly disliked the high taxes before, and reducing them when there is an abnormally large surplus makes some sense, especially because it can help lower income folks. But having researched these new board members, and there's a link on thinkwingradio.com to my research, I'm not sure that when they were elected, they were sure whether they could actually lower the taxes while still meeting the board's obligations. I think Barker and Ramsey in particular were flippant about groundwater subsidence, which we've talked about before on the show as a serious issue. I think this new board has good intentions, but I don't know how well they'll do in office. But they are in office, so we'll just have to see what happens.
I guess I would make a couple of adjustments to what you were saying. First of all, these are not taxes, they're usage fees.
That's true.
And I have a feeling that it won't make much of a difference to the average user, but I would also suspect that the people that are new to the board that reduce the fees are thinking of big users who will mostly benefit from the reduction, because that's how these things work. I'm increasingly suspicious of using surpluses. I'm not a betting man, but I'd bet a buck. That's probably the case. I'm increasingly suspicious of using surpluses for rate reductions instead of service or infrastructure improvements. Mm-hmm. This is money that will be very hard to get back, even for beneficial uses. And, you know, they could have just kept the rate steady for the next 2 years or the next 4 years, and that would have worked too. But their costs of supplying water are going to increase, and rates are going to be flat or lower. Part of my suspicion is rooted in the fact that this seems to have been a nonpartisan election, making it much harder to assess political motivations behind policy proposals.
Yep.
I think both Andrew and I'm going to speak for you now. I think we are both against nonpartisan elections because I think that they're basically false advertising.
Absolutely. There is virtually no aspect of governance in the United States left that is not in some way, shape, or form influenced or directly affected by partisan politics. So.
Okay, our next story is also from CommunityImpact.com. HPD alleges Kingwood Water Plant doctored samples showing sewage had been properly treated. The Houston Police Department is alleging officials with Inframark, a third-party contractor operating the Kingwood Central Wastewater Treatment Plant, doctored samples and records to suggest the plant had adequately treated sewage before releasing it into a waterway that feeds into one of the city's main sources of drinking water, according to a search warrant released February 22nd. According to Houston Police Sergeant Patrick Morrissey, there is probable cause to believe that raw sewage and/or pollutants are being discharged into Ben's Branch, a waterway, a direct discharge point into Lake Houston, Morrissey wrote in an affidavit. Evidence described herein shows that lab reports and other reports have been falsified to indicate that these discharges were in compliance with state permits and the Texas Water Code, when in fact they were not. While investigators said the drinking water taken from Lake Houston is treated at separate plants before it is consumed, officials maintain the sewage entering the Ben's Branch waterway would not have passed regulatory standards. Houston Public Works officials have stressed that the city's water supply has remained safe to consume. The warrant cites several statutes that may have been violated, including a Texas Water Code statute deeming it illegal to discharge pollutants and a separate felony statute deeming it illegal to discharge pollutants knowingly or intentionally. It also cites the Texas Penal Code stating it is illegal to tamper with government records. I collect quotes. I don't mention that much these days, but I collect quotes. I've got like dozens of pages of quotes, and I'm not sure a publicly owned corporation would be immune from this very human sort of butt covering. But there's one quote that applies very, very often from a series called Reaper that broadcast in 2009, and it's a great quote. It's from the devil. He says, "Did you know, beginning in the late 19th century, corporations were granted all the rights of the individual, but none of the annoying responsibilities. They lack, almost by design, any kind of moral compass, conscience, or compassion. Basically, corporations are a way to enact sociopathic behavior on a grand scale. In short, they're what makes this country so damn great." If you're the devil, you might agree with that. Andrew?
Well, I think the difference between corporations and sociopaths is that sociopaths still overwhelmingly see the benefit in respecting others and getting the support of society. Corporations don't care because they've rigged society to support them regardless. As for this specific story, I'm glad city water is still safe to drink, though we've had far too many water scandals in Houston recently. Hopefully this investigation is part of a larger trend of regulators and watchdogs taking a closer look to keep Houston water safe.
Our next story is from Yahoo News via nativenewsonline.net. Bipartisan legislation reintroduced to solidify tribal trust agreements. In a bipartisan and bicameral move, lawmakers in the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House today reintroduced legislation to amend the Act of June 18, 1934, known as the Indian Reorganization Act. This legislation, which has been introduced in every Congress since 2009, would reaffirm the authority of the Secretary of the Interior to take land into trust for Indian tribes and for other purposes. The legislation further removes the uncertainty and ambiguities inherent within the Carcieri v. Salazar opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court. In 2009, the court overturned that long-established precedent in Carcieri v. Salazar, and in addition to generating expensive litigation for certain tribes, the decision caused uncertainty and unequal treatment among federally recognized tribes operating on existing tribal trust lands. In 2019, the amended legislation advanced out of the U.S. House of Representatives for the first time on a bipartisan vote and did so again in 2021. However, in both years, it died in the Senate. Monday's legislation was introduced in the Senate by Senator Jerry Moran, Republican of Kansas, and Senator John Tester, Democrat of Montana. In the House, the legislation was introduced by Representative Tom Cole, Representative of Oklahoma and a tribal citizen of the Chickasaw Nation, and by Representative Betty McCullum, Democrat of Minnesota. Cole, co-chair of the Congressional Native American Caucus, said in a statement, "I am proud to reintroduce this important legislation to keep the promises made to tribes, respect their sovereign status, and validate the status of tribal lands acquired in trust by the Secretary of Interior." Cole went on, "I look forward to working with my colleagues to pass this bill in both chambers and get it to the president's desk." Tester, who serves on the Senate Committee for Indian Affairs, sees the legislation as a means to further economic development in Indian country. Tester said in a statement, "It's critically important to ensure all tribes have equal access to economic development opportunities. That's why my bipartisan bill would overturn the Supreme Court's disastrous Carcieri decision, which created two classes of tribes and would allow all tribes to take land into trust moving forward." So, clarifying fuzzy law or legal decisions through specific legislation can be a good thing. It sounds like this bill, if it passes the House and Senate, will clarify or re-clarify tribal rights and ownership to land that was otherwise complicated by an earlier Supreme Court decision. We will be talking about U.S. government aid to chip makers after this quick break. This is ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org. You can download it with Google Podcasts, available from either the Android or iPhone app stores, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this show. I'm assuming you know at least one of those three ways to listen to this show, because you're listening right now, I'm assuming. However, there may be two other ways about which you did not know, so consider that a public service announcement. KPFT is Houston's community media with about 100 show titles. To do that means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming like this show. You can show your support for ThinkWing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, perhaps ours, and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between. And you may qualify for a lovely thank you gift. And tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps us too, and it's free. Our next story is from Al Jazeera and Reuters. U.S. government to chip makers, share profits if you want subsidies. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has said it will require companies winning funds from its $52 billion semiconductor manufacturing and research program to share excess profits and explain how they plan to provide employees with affordable child care. The U.S. Commerce Department on Tuesday released plans to begin accepting applications in late June for a $39 billion manufacturing subsidy program. The funding is part of the CHIPS and Science Act, which President Biden signed into law last August. The law also creates a 25% investment tax credit for building chip plants estimated to be worth another $24 billion. The CHIPS Act plays a central role in the Biden administration's effort to bring semiconductor manufacturing back to the U.S. Its success is vital to U.S. ambitions to keep ahead of China in global markets. Recipients who receive more than $150 million in direct funding, quote, will be required to share with the U.S. government a portion of any cash flows or returns that exceed the applicant's projections by an agreed-upon threshold. Commerce also expects upside sharing will only be material in instances where the project significantly exceeds its projected cash flow or returns and will not exceed 75% of the recipient's direct funding award. In other words, they'll keep at least 25% of that award. Democratic Senator Jack Reed praised the profit-sharing plan, saying CHIPS funding is, quote, not a free handout for multi-billion dollar tech companies. There is no downside for companies that participate because they only have to share a portion of future profits if they do exceedingly well. The rules also require that companies ensure that high-quality and affordable child care is available at the plant for construction workers and operators. This could include building company child care centers near construction sites or new plants, paying local child care providers to add capacity at an affordable cost, or directly subsidizing workers' care costs, the New York Times reported. Republican House Science Committee Chair Frank Lucas criticized the child care and revenue sharing provisions, saying they exceeded the authority granted by the U.S. Congress. He said the Commerce Department was, quote, focusing less on the urgent need for chip production and more on attempting to impose their labor agenda on this critical industry, unquote. Applicants must address six program priority areas, including plans to commit to investing in R&D in the U.S. semiconductor industry, such as by building domestic R&D facilities. Applicants should also, quote, create opportunities for minority-owned, veteran-owned, and women-owned businesses, demonstrate climate and environmental responsibility, invest in their communities by addressing barriers to economic inclusion, and commit to using iron, steel, and construction materials produced in the United States. The Semiconductor Industry Association said it was carefully reviewing the funding notice that lays out the rules of the road for companies to apply for the CHIP Act's manufacturing grants. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo also noted that companies winning awards will be required to enter into agreements restricting their ability to expand semiconductor manufacturing capacity in foreign countries of concern, like China, for 10 years after winning funding. They cannot engage in any joint research or licensing efforts with a foreign entity of concern involving sensitive technologies. My first thought when I read this story is that while I agree with the goals expressed by the administration, I think they're worthy, I almost wonder whether companies are going to agonize over taking federal money with these kinds of strings attached. Hmm. My second thought was that Republicans like Frank Lucas have become so cartoonishly predictable in their criticisms of Democratic policies, they really should just grow mustaches so they can twirl them while they speak. Andrew?
Well, my first thought was that this sounds a lot like something I said back in our show from February 8th. I'm quoting myself here. Government support to businesses should come with the condition that a supermajority of their operational expansion happens in the U.S. Now, this policy isn't an exact implementation of that, but it is in a similar spirit. For example, companies taking these grants have to build research facilities in the U.S. and buy construction materials from U.S. companies. In other words, they have to commit to contributing to the U.S. economy and not just take our tax money and run. So I'm going to take this as vindication. Although, funnily, the restrictions on expanding operations in other nations is sort of the inverse of my position. Instead of requiring the expansion to be in the U.S., it just says, don't expand in our geopolitical rivals, because, of course, the great game has to be shoehorned in. So I don't love that. I think you do make a good point, Mike, that companies may be reluctant to take these grants because they're averse to even the smallest amount of risk. But the worst that could happen there, I think, is that the U.S.'s semiconductor production capability stays the same as it is now. So I don't think there's any need to water down the obligations placed on beneficiaries of this policy. I think there's very little risk, both to these companies and to the U.S. government, and this is mostly a welcome move.
I think it's worth noting that we have trade allies, military allies, trade allies, pact allies, who are really, really annoyed at the requirements to do things like Buy American. They're basically saying it interferes with their their metals industries, their auto industries, their technology industries. And actually, we've discussed this on an earlier show that these things happen. And generally speaking, a country, even in these various treaties, is allowed to take its own national security needs into consideration. And that country then takes some lumps in terms of tariffs that its allies can invoke. So just in case people were thinking about that when we were reading this story, yeah, that's being taken into account.
Action and reaction, swings and roundabouts, these sorts of things. It's a matter of whether the potential risks are worth the potential advantages.
The potential costs, as it were. Okay, from politico.eu. And this is actually from last week. Russia envoy accuses U.S. of fueling Ukraine war with crimes against humanity's charge. And the reason I'm going to a story from last week is because I think it deserves some discussion. We didn't have time. Washington is trying to demonize Russia and fuel the Ukrainian crisis by accusing Moscow of crimes against humanity, said Russian ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, on Sunday last week. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris announced Saturday that Washington has formally determined that Russia is committing crimes against humanity in Ukraine in an address at the Munich Security Conference in Germany. In a message on the social media network Telegram, Antonov, the Russian ambassador, said, "We consider such insinuations as an attempt, unprecedented in terms of its cynicism, to demonize Russia in the course of a hybrid war unleashed against us," meaning Russia. "There is no doubt that the purpose of such attacks is to justify Washington's own actions to fuel the Ukrainian crisis," he said. Harris, however, said Russia is responsible for a widespread and systematic attack against Ukraine's civilian population, committing war crimes, as the administration formally concluded last March, and illegal acts against non-combatants. She cited evidence of execution-style killings, rape, torture, and forcible deportations. Andrew, you want to start?
Yeah. I think the truth matters. I think we should strive to know with as much certainty as possible what did and did not happen in war so that harm can be remedied where possible and prevented in the future. I know that allegations of crimes against humanity, both true and untrue, have been weaponized in conflicts before. In this conflict, I have heard allegations leveled at both the Russian and Ukrainian governments, and I find them plausible because I know that there are extremist elements on both sides. For all of these reasons, I want a serious and fair investigation of all allegations of crimes against humanity in this invasion, not for the purpose of demonizing either side, but for the benefit of the people harmed and for historical record.
Now, as kind of an FYI, I want to distinguish at least my understanding of the difference between a war crime being committed by individual warriors or units versus a crime against humanity, which I would believe is more the result of a government policy or the policy of a higher up. So in U.S. history, for example, the excesses of the U.S. Indian Wars were crimes against humanity as we would consider them today, whereas the murders at the Vietnamese village of My Lai, those were a war crime committed by a unit. If Russia is committing crimes against humanity, and there seems to be ample and growing evidence that it is, at least committing lots of war crimes, possibly as a matter of policy, then demonizing the Russian government and military may be entirely appropriate because they may be doing demonic sorts of things. This isn't a judgment about whether the U.S. has ever committed, let me rephrase. This isn't a matter of whether the U.S. has itself ever committed a war crime. It's not a matter of whether the U.S. has ever committed crimes against humanity. And sometimes these things are decided by who's the winner and who's the loser. But I think it's an important thing to contemplate. Yeah, the Russians have apparently done some horrible things during this war. It appears to be, if not national policy, at least military policy. And it's something that has to be looked at and, if necessary, brought to the international court.
Yeah, I believe the same for the Ukrainian side. And yeah, I think we need to know what's happening. We need to have a conclusive investigation because otherwise we'll be trying to make decisions off of assumptions and hearsay and half-baked truths. And those decisions don't usually end well, especially when people's lives are on the line.
Okay, another story that we didn't get a chance to discuss last week from, again, politico.eu. Russia deploys nuclear-armed ships for the first time in 30 years, Norway says. Tactical nuclear weapons are a particularly serious threat, Norwegian intelligence report says. Russia has begun deploying tactical nuclear weapon-armed ships in the Baltic Sea for the first time in 30 years, said the Norwegian intelligence service in its annual report. The key part of the nuclear potential is on the submarines and surface ships of the Russian Northern Fleet, the intel noted. The Northern Fleet warships regularly went to sea with nuclear weapons during the Cold War era, but this is the first time the modern Russian Federation has done the same, the report added. While Russia also has submarine capabilities, anti-satellite weapons, and cyber capabilities that could threaten Norway and the NATO military alliance, tactical nuclear weapons are, quote, a particularly serious threat in several operational scenarios in which NATO countries may be involved. The Norwegian intelligence also noted that an escalation of a localized war into a wider conflict involving the United States, NATO, and Norway cannot be ruled out. The agency assessed that while Russia will maintain, modernize, and develop its nuclear arsenal, no significant changes in Russian nuclear doctrine are expected in the coming years. That's actually the whole article, short and to the point.
Hmm.
Now, this is, yeah, I mean, that's unusual.
Yeah.
This is kind of where we all take a deep, calming breath. As the article points out, this is not the first time Russian ships have carried nukes, and the U.S. has done the same. Even now, U.S. subs carry and have been carrying nuclear-armed missiles with MIRVs, otherwise known as multiple independently targeted reentry vehicles. These subs alone could probably destroy Russia. What makes this information a bit unnerving is that Putin has done some unprecedented nuclear saber-rattling. This doesn't change Russian nuclear doctrine, though, more like it emphasizes it. Andrew?
Well, I think that this article is kind of connected to comments that we've made in the past on this show about the idea of a doctrine of strength. I think the problem with a doctrine of strength is that it only works when your opponent gets intimidated and caves. If everybody is using a doctrine of strength, nobody wants to look weak because that's an integral part of it. So nobody caves, so the pressure builds and builds. You know, I really hope we get at least one new world leader who can look up from the death spiral for a bit, ideally sometime before the big red button gets pushed in a fit of rage.
A couple of quick comments. Mm-hmm. Russian doctrine isn't changing because Russian doctrine already is escalate to de-escalate, which is not a good doctrine. What it means is you drop a small tactical nuke, everybody freaks out. And it's like, let's just calm this down. So their strategy in doctrine is, in the final extremity, escalate with a tactical nuke so that you can de-escalate the war and everybody decides to negotiate. That's,
I would consider that under the umbrella of a doctrine of strength. It's not the only doctrine of strength, but I would call it one.
Yeah, but it's also a doctrine of intimidation.
Which is what I basically think a doctrine of strength is. I think intimidation is a core part of that. And I think that that works if you have people who are smart enough to see the intimidation and go, okay, this could get bad. Let's take a step back. The problem is that sometimes that's exactly what the enemy wants, which is, you know, difficult.
Now,
it just makes it all difficult.
I will also say, and this is something that I tossed out in a show, I think it was before your time, Andrew, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe not.
There's plenty of time. That's before my
time.
Now,
so it's gotten to be quite a while.
Yeah.
I'm thinking like maybe once every couple of generations, it might not be a bad idea to conduct a small atmospheric nuclear test someplace, invite all the world's leaders, all the world's elites, and just let them see what it looks like for real. I'm thinking a little atmospheric radiation might be worth really scaring, pardon me, the crap out of people.
You know, I see where you're coming from, and I don't entirely disagree where you're coming from. I have to wonder if the same effect can be hammered home by having them watch, because there's some pretty scary, like, nuclear, what is called nuclear Holocaust fiction out there. If you can get some of the things, especially the stuff that's like, oh, God, what was it? Was it, I think it's called Threads, where
there have been several movies showing the results of an atomic holocaust, of on the beach, is one that was from the 1950s. I mean, they just, I don't think that they have the impact of, in a manner of speaking, the nuclear wind blowing through your hair.
You may have a point there. I think they're effective for regular people, but I have to wonder if the rich and powerful have enough, well, delusions of grandeur that they consider themselves immune from that kind of thing. One piece of media I will point out, though, is DEFCON, which is a video game where you control the nuclear arsenal of one of the nuclear-capable countries in the world.
Yeah, and but there it still doesn't give you nuclear sunburn.
It doesn't, but it makes you press the button, and there is no way to de-escalate. Everybody dies. That's the tagline of the game, everybody dies. So I think, you know, it's going to be effective for some people, not everybody. But I like your thinking. I just wonder if we can do it in less of a directly dangerous way to human life.
Hey, it's only once every half century, a small nuke, just a small nuke. I will also mention there used to be a show called That Was the Week That Was. And I think I think the sketch was on that particular show. I've never been able to find a record of it.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And there was a sketch where they're talking about like a satirical war game for kids, a war toy, like a small nuke.
Oh, yeah.
And the tagline was, be the first kid on your block to be the last kid on your block.
Okay. All right.
I've remembered that for like 50 years.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It was a real catchy phrase. Yeah. Okay, you're listening still to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show, and you probably know at least one of these three things, live online at kpft.org. Of course, HD2, your radio has one of those, so actually that's four things. Download on Google Podcasts, either on your Android or iPhone through either App Store, or by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this and over 100 other KPFT programs. We heavily excerpt almost every story on the show, which is why we include links to full articles on the show posts and more page at thinkwingradio.com. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738, extension 1. That's 713-526-5738, extension 1. And you can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig. I'm on Twitter at Think Wing Radio, plus Andrew has his accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Our next story is from Reuters. Earthquake death toll in Turkey rises above 45,000. The death toll in Turkey from last month's devastating earthquake has risen to 45,089, the Disaster and Emergency Management Authority said on Wednesday, bringing the total, including Syria, to about 51,000. President Erdogan has pledged to rebuild homes within a year, but it will be many months before thousands can leave tents or container housing and daily queues for food and move into permanent housing. More than 160,000 Turkish buildings containing 520,000 apartments, I mean, it's just hard to wrap your head around, collapsed or were severely damaged in the disaster, the worst in the country's modern history. Some 2 million people were registered as having fled the region, which has been hit by more than 11,000 aftershocks since the initial quake. From a prior story from February 13th, it's worth noting that videos show that Turkey's Erdogan boasted letting builders avoid earthquake codes. I have a link to the story, but the first paragraph goes, as Turkish President Erdogan struggles to defend his response to the devastating 7.8 initial earthquake, videos from a few years back have emerged showing him hailing some of the housing projects that crumbled, killing thousands of people. Critics say contractors were allowed to skip crucial safety regulations, increasing their profits, but putting residents at risk. I believe recent stories are that now the Turkish government has arrested a couple of hundred contractors and saying they're responsible, but, you know, responsible with permission, which is not the part they mention.
Right.
There's a lesson here for conservatives, libertarians, and greedy business people who complain about building codes making housing too expensive. The lesson is that some affordable housing is only affordable until it kills you. So well-written and thoughtful government regulation, what I call right regulating, is a good thing. The devil is always in the details, but more often than not, it can be life-saving and protect you from unnecessary dangers at work and at home. Andrew?
Well, I think you've said all that needs to be said there. How about I take the next article off your hands?
Sure.
All right. This article is from CNN. It's by Jackie Waddles. After a historic first mission, what does the future hold for this controversial rocket? This is from January 20th of this year. There have been numerous delays with the development of the rocket at the center of the Artemis 1 mission, NASA's Space Launch System, or SLS, the most powerful rocket ever flown, and one of the most controversial. The towering launch vehicle was originally expected to take flight in 2016, and the decade plus that the rocket was in development sparked years of blistering criticism targeted toward the space agency and Boeing, which holds the primary contract for the SLS rocket's core. In various op-eds, the rocket has also been deemed, quote, the result of unfortunate compromises and unholy politics, a colossal waste of money, and an irredeemable mistake. Despite all the heated debate that has followed SLS, by all accounts, the rocket is here to stay, and officials at NASA and Boeing said its first launch 2 months ago was practically flawless. Many have questioned why SLS needs to exist at all. The bottom line is there's nothing else like the SLS because it was built from the ground up to be human-rated. The SLS rocket ended up flying its first launch more than 6 years later than originally intended. NASA had allocated $6.2 billion to the SLS program as of 2018, but that price tag more than tripled to $23 billion as of 2022, according to an analysis by the Planetary Society. Boeing SLS program manager John Shannon acknowledged in an interview that Boeing and SLS have faced loud detractors, but he said that the value of the drawn-out development and testing program would become evident as SLS flies. Boeing's Shannon said, "You see a vehicle that is not just visually spectacular, but its performance was spectacular, and it really put us on the road to be able to do lunar exploration again, which is something that's very important in this country." But the rocket is still facing criticism. During a congressional hearing with the House's Science, Space, and Technology Committee in March 2022, NASA's Inspector General said that current cost estimates for SLS were, quote, unsustainable, gauging that the space agency will have spent $93 billion on the Artemis program from 2012 through September 2025. In a December 7th statement to CNN, Boeing once again defended SLS and its price point, saying in part, quote, when adjusted for inflation, NASA has developed a SLS for a quarter of the cost of the Saturn V and half the cost of the space shuttle, the statement noted. Now that the Artemis first mission has returned safely home, NASA and Boeing can turn to preparing more of the gargantuan SLS rockets to launch even loftier missions. Shannon, the Boeing SLS program manager, told CNN that construction of the next two SLS rocket cores is well underway, with the booster for Artemis II on track to be finished in April, more than a year before the mission is scheduled to take off. All of the major components for a third SLS rocket are also completed, Shannon added. For the third SLS core and beyond, Boeing is also moving final assembly to new facilities in Florida, freeing up space at its manufacturing facilities to increase production, which may help drive down costs. My comments, the killer point against all criticism of SLS financially continues to be that it is costing a quarter of what Saturn V did after inflation. All other critiques are of aspects of the program that can and will be addressed and improved. The cost is much harder to improve, but I really don't think it needs to be improved. I also am critical of the public-private partnership outlook thrust upon NASA, but I'll go to bat for it if the alternative is SpaceX. Even if it means contracting with SpaceX, so long as the missions are still NASA and the astronauts answer to the public rather than shareholders, I'll accept it. The risks of space travel are already great under eternal political pressure to do more with less. Private pressure to do everything with nothing would result in a lot of failed launches. And if a private rocket did get off the ground, do you want the first humans to meet alien species working for you or for your boss? I know my answer.
You know, there are a couple of interesting historical points about the SLS. It was originally designed this way because it was thought it would be cheaper than developing a rocket from scratch. It uses an extended solid rocket booster system that's derived from the shuttle. It uses engines that were originally designed for the shuttle. The logic at the time was, we already have some of these parts built. We have the technology and know how to build them. Surely it will be much cheaper to build a more powerful rocket using stuff that we already build and know how to build.
Makes sense.
It did make sense. It was perfectly logical at the time, and I don't think anybody really had a serious argument with it unless they were just against manned spaceflight.
Yeah.
Now, another hint about this is that the shuttle was called the STS, the Space Transportation System.
Mm.
It is probably not a coincidence that this became the SLS, the Space Launch System.
Yeah.
Because not only are the parts derived from the space shuttle, but the name is derived from the space shuttle. So, I mean, I just think those are a kind of an interesting couple of bits of history. I'll also point out, I'm not sure if it was in the excerpt that we read, because this was a much longer story. It's interesting. Mm. I want to look it up from the website. But the original Apollo program up through 1972, I guess, which is when they had the last shuttle, the last Apollo flight, $25 billion in basically 1970 dollars. So today, that would be something like $200 billion. So the fact that in modern dollars, this is under $100 billion, it's at least half the price in adjusted for inflation dollars, and it could very well be 25% of the price.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, Oh, I can never remember the senator's name from the 1960s, Republican senator, came up with a great quote, a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon you're talking real money.
I think we did try to research that once, and the origin was disputed. But I also cannot remember the person that we commonly attribute it to.
Yeah, he was an interesting character. Yeah, I will say that he also did a 45 record a version of the song Wild Thing by the Troggs. And it's a testament to how well-liked and famous he was that it actually was like a top 40 hit.
Okay. Now this was already in my browser's history. It was a suggested link, which means that I've looked this up before, but it is from the Dirksen Congressional Center.
Yes. Everett Dirksen.
Yeah. Everett Dirksen. Yep.
Yep. Yeah, he was an interesting character. He was a Republican senator before it was easy to hate Republican senators.
Now, something interesting. The page says, did he say this? Perhaps not. So, who knows?
But, well, if you go to the website, thinkwingradio.com, that story where we mention three kinds of lies, lies, damn lies, and statistics, I have linked there to a whole lengthy discussion about whether that is actually originally a quote from Mark Twain or whether he simply reused the quote in sort of his own words, and because he was Mark Twain, he got the credit for it. Okay, you have been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's Community Media, KPFT 90.1 FM HD2. My co-host and indispensable editor and guy who can save my vocal cords is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you found the show interesting. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we hope we'll be able to chat with you again next week. Y'all take care.
See you later. Let's keep on looking for the light. Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside.
Make the connection between your favorite programs on KPFT and your power to keep them on the air. As a nonprofit organization, we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We count on listeners like you for donations, programming, and much of our staffing. That's how KPFT and Pacifica Radio work. Without listener support, 90.1 would be radio silence. Your contribution keeps the lights on, powers our transmitters, and covers our bandwidth. Becoming a member is quick, easy, tax-deductible, and secure. Just call or text GIVE to 713-526-5738 or go online to kpft.org. Become a member today and join the special group of heroes who keep KPFT on the air and free for everyone. You have the power. Connect to 526-5738 or go to kpft.org today.
Hi, this is the Blues Hound.
And I'm Colleen.
Please join us on Sundays between the hours of 2 and 5 p.m. for Hound the Blues, where you'll hear us spinning the best new blues releases we can get our hands on. Whether it's the newest contemporary artist or simply old school cool, we'll bring the blues to you in all of its many flavors, commercial free, and with as little talk as possible.
Thanks for inviting us into your homes each week and giving us the privilege to serve as your link to the blues world and our local blues community.
That's Hound the Blues, Sundays from 2 to 5 p.m. right here on 90.1 FM, KPFT, Houston's community station.